Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and our friends at SimpliSafe. And our guest, we welcome back Adam White, longtime contributor both to the Weekly Standard and to the Bulwark. And Adam's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and assistant professor of law at George Mason University, where he directs the Scalia Law School Center for the Study of the Administrative State. You get that all on a business card? I've asked you this before, right?
It's a pretty big business card, I'll be honest.
Yeah. So you're new at the American Enterprise Institute. Everybody getting along with one another? I mean, do you sit around, think deep thoughts?
Well, so far, so good. I'm in a nice neighborhood between Yuval Levin and Matt Continetti. Just a quick note on that. You know, Yuval, in sort of the changes happening at AEI, Yuval and the head of AEI, Robert Doerr, founded an entirely new department called the Program on Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies, an effort to kind of reinvigorate the old Irving Kristol, Antonin Scalia part of AEI. And what I like most about it is the fact that it groups together social, cultural, and constitutional studies, which I think is a useful reminder that the Constitution comes at the end of all that, not at the beginning.
Yeah, I always wonder, you know, with the think tanks, whether people actually show up at a building and, you know, think together, think deep thoughts together. Are you walking back and forth to the, I imagine you have an espresso maker, you know, people with you know, in cardigans and pipes saying, hey, good morning, Yuval. What deep thought are you thinking today?
Yeah, honestly, I just push
pretty much like that.
I just push a button on my desk and people bring all of these refreshments to me in my specially designed think tank chamber.
Okay, well, you and I are both going to annoy a good portion of our audience here because I think we're on the same page. I've been trying to crank up my outrage and disdain for the NBA, but the problem is that I've sort of, you know, been there for about 20 years, and I saw that you tweeted out that you are so outraged by the spinelessness of the NBA, you know, in regards to China, that you're going to start boycotting them. What was it?
About 20 years ago.
20 years ago. Yeah, that's the thing. The LeBron James thing is one of those moments where you do wonder, and do people listen to themselves? Does it sound one way in their heads? And then when they say it, do they understand how foolish it actually sounds? And I guess part of it is, you know, LeBron James, you know, like a lot of these other NBA players and types of, you know, have, you know, patted themselves on the back for speaking out and taking a stand and using their position. And yet when it comes to dealing with China's crackdown in Hong Kong, it's like a totally different moral universe. And they just can't bring themselves to do it.
I did hear LeBron's quote, and I'm sort of grateful that he was kind of accidentally, you know, honest about it. He said that what Maury had done had risked injuring people financially. And then he sort of said, not just financially, but also, I can't remember what else he said, emotionally, spiritually, physically. It was, but the point is, and LeBron, you know, is clearly conceding it, that this is really about money. And considering that the NBA is by far the most woke of the major professional sports leagues, but just in general in sports, we're now coming off of the aftermath of the Colin Kaepernick stuff and Nike's, you know, support for Colin chasing his dreams. You know, it's unfortunate Nike and the others don't have time to, you know, support the dreams of you know, millions of people in Hong Kong. But I guess those people are too far away to matter.
Yeah, and I mean, here's this. I actually had it up on my screen, and then something flipped on it. The you know, what a tough week they'd had, and maybe you should have waited a week to send the tweet. And, you know, just to remind people that the tweet that started all this was basically just a, hey, we stand with Hong Kong, and it was not that controversial. Well, actually, it shouldn't have been, unless of course the prime directive was you must always kowtow to the red Chinese. Okay, so we're done with the NBA. Let's talk about impeachment and what's going on now with impeachment. I mean, this is such a fast moving story. There are hearings every day, most of them behind closed doors. I don't want to get to this. The story is about Rudy Giuliani, are truly extraordinary. America's mayor is in a lot of trouble, and his lousy week just got a lot worse. You had the New York Times reporting on Friday that he was under investigation by his own shop at SDNY. Now the Wall Street Journal is matching that. He's now acknowledging, according to Reuters, that he pocketed $500,000 from those, you know, crooked Ukrainians. What was the name of the company? Like, you know, Fraud Guaranteed or something.
Yeah.
It's almost beyond. So, you know, this is moving ahead at warp speed. And now I don't know whether you had on your bingo card, John Bolton turns on Trump. That's actually not the flakiest thing that we've seen. But now it looks like John Bolton is among those who's rattling the cage. And his name is showing up in a lot of this testimony is objecting to the shadow diplomacy of Rudy Giuliani in their attempt to smear both the Bidens and as well as get rid of the Ukrainian ambassador. But let's just talk about the way the House is handling it. It seems to me that at the moment, almost all of the criticism of the House Democrats is procedural rather than substantive. We'll get to the substance in 5 minutes, metaphorically. But a lot of objections to the way the House is proceeding. And I know you've given some thought to all of this, including their decision, number one, not to have an impeachment inquiry vote, and number two, to hold these hearings in secret.
Let me preface this by saying, you know, your point about all the sort of rogue diplomacy and so on, the framers, you know, in their defense of the Constitution and in the Federalist and elsewhere, they made clear that the process for appointing ambassadors and other officers matters, that a president, even a good president left to his own devices, would have a great temptation to just appoint the people that he wants around him. And that we need the Senate as sort of a check on that to ensure that the president has a reason to really appoint statesmen. And, you know, in modern times, we've found plenty of workarounds for this, especially the appointment of acting officers. But the problem is the process matters, that these things are worth doing for the sake of the system itself. And when you get casual about these things, appointing ambassadors, appointing officers, appointing cabinet secretaries, the system falls apart in totally predictable ways. Now, I say all that as a preface to what the House is now doing, because the House, full of zeal and eager to chase down the president's, you know, actions and responsibility for these weird interactions with Ukraine, including the president's own direct involvement in it. I'm very sympathetic to the House looking into this. This, what we're seeing already in the public record on its face, raises profound questions and possible, you know, impeachment-worthy actions by the president. But what worries me is that the House, full of zeal on all of this, seems to be dead set on going about all of this in the worst possible way to confirm not just current suspicion about the partisan House, but timeless suspicion about the nature of a House of Representatives, timeless suspicion about the nature of impeachment when done badly. And from the moment this process has begun, whether it was Speaker Pelosi's sort of casual announcement of an impeachment inquiry instead of a real precise vote on a precise resolution, or whether it's Schiff playing fast and loose with his opening remarks, his account of President Trump's comments to the Ukrainian president, all of this seems by the House to be calculated almost to do the most possible damage to the House itself.
So let's walk through these things that you think are the worst possible way. The secrecy. I'm not trying to carry any water for anybody, but I think their line would be this is just part of the investigative process. He will have his due process rights, be able to confront his accusers, but we want to gather the evidence. And this is the most effective way to do it so that the witnesses are not intimidated, so that witnesses don't know what other people have said. Is that a legitimate response? Is that a legitimate case to make that at this point in the process, it's not necessary that the hearings be public because everything will be public at some point?
Sure. And it's totally understandable. I understand why they think that this is the way to best bring witnesses forward. At the same time, we should all be candid about the costs of this approach. There's no free lunch, not even in this. And that the cost of secrecy for the sake of pursuing these witnesses is that it will create a shadow of partisanship around all of this. The lack of transparency about who's being asked what. The fact is we will get some information out of these closed hearings, except it'll just be through leaks. So everybody will get sort of one-sided or tactical views into what's happening in there. It really does raise questions about what exactly is going on in there. What the House is doing is perfectly well calibrated for putting together a document that accuses the president of impeachable offenses. And after all, that's the House's job. The House's job is not to try impeachments, but to accuse presidents of impeachments. The thing is, whatever the House is doing for the sake of putting together a good sort of indictment of the president is not good for actually airing a public case that the president is, in fact, guilty of these things. We're supposed to trust the Senate for this. Whether the Senate will actually come through and do its job in an impeachment inquiry is a separate question. But at the present moment, if the House is really truly concerned about demonstrating to the people that the president has, in fact, done impeachable offenses, and the House wants its own judgment to be taken seriously, not just as an accusation, but as an actual judgment, then it needs to open up to transparency, even at the cost at the corners, at the margins, for maybe getting a couple extra witnesses to say a couple extra things, especially, by the way, at a moment when the record in public already is extremely damning of the president.
You know, so there's two separate elements here to the impeachment process, which you're outlining. You know, number one, obviously, is it is a legalistic or legalish process, although the Constitution doesn't spell out exactly what the procedures are. And then it is ultimately a political process. And this is the sort of the paradox of the whole process, because as you point out, one of the things the Democrats have to do is make their charges credible, educate the public, bring the public along. They can do that with these public hearings. What they're doing is they seem to be following sort of a grand jury like approach. I say like, obviously there's a lot of differences to the hearings, but that's at the expense of the public transparent political task they have, which is convincing America that the president has committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah. You go back and look at the debates at the founding about the impeachment power. There's a reason why the framers gave the power to try impeachments to the Senate, not the House. The Senate was a little bit more removed from day-to-day politics. It was expected to be filled with a greater kind of statesman. The House, for all of its virtues, was going to be the branch most directly tied to the winds of politics, most quickly impassioned by political energy, and the least reliable to actually render a dispassionate verdict on something of this magnitude. That's why the framers put the House in charge of, like I said, accusing presidents of impeachable offenses, not actually finding the presidents guilty of impeachable offenses. And so if Congress, if the House really wants to just do a good job of accusing the president of impeachable offenses, right? They want to be seen as a credible advocate against the president. I guess they're doing a good job of it. But if what they ultimately want to do is to convince the public, both today and in the eyes of history, that their impeachment accusation itself is worthy of sort of public respect as a dispassionate exercise in finding the facts of what happened here, then they need to sacrifice some of those prosecutorial tactics for the sake of better transparent judgment.
What did you think of the White House counsel letter? Is it Pat Cipollone or Cipollone?
I pronounce it Cipollone. I could be wrong though.
Okay, well we'll just pretend we know. That letter which laid out the reasons to refuse to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry. We have a piece of the Bulwark today by Greg Wiener, who basically says, look, this is an attack not just on its recipients, the House Democrats, but fundamentally on the relationship between Congress and the executive branch, because Trump is claiming for himself the authority to determine the legitimacy of legislative oversight. And so he's saying that letter alone might be a cause for impeachment because it's a broadside against the system of checks and balances. And suggest impeaching the president for this extraordinary claim of executive authority, and then lays out why that would have, you know, important advantages as opposed to his actions. Basically, make it about the institutional integrity. I think that's unlikely to happen, but it was an extraordinary moment. Wasn't an extraordinary moment in constitutional law when the president's attorney and maybe the president himself dictated it comes out with this letter with this really novel, extraordinary claim of imperial executive power.
Yeah, I think that the White House counsel's letter is beneath the office of the White House counsel. I think it's a profoundly disappointing letter in every possible respect. It starts, the first third of the letter or so is nominally a legal analysis. It's a legal analysis that stretches precedent, both legal precedent and institutional precedent, beyond the breaking point, I think. The suggestion that it's not just a good thing for the House to begin with a full House resolution, but it's a constitutional necessity that it begin with a full House resolution, that there's no support for that position. Likewise, taking sort of broad statements from the court that, you know, due process applies, the right of due process applies in congressional hearings, in addition to criminal trials, to take that sort of truism and then stretch it to say that the president, therefore, is constitutionally entitled to cross-examine witnesses, to have a counsel present, and all these other things, that, too, is a bridge too far. And what's frustrating about it, then, of course, the rest of the argument is just a political tirade, again, beneath the dignity of the White House counsel's office. But even just looking at the legal analysis, what frustrates me most is that it takes what are plausible and I think actually well-justified prudential arguments, right, that it's good for the House to begin with the full resolution, that it's good for the House to afford the president and the witnesses even more due process rights than they might be technically entitled to, that these things are good for the sake of transparency, accountability, and ultimately the legitimacy of the process. I agree with all of that. The problem comes when you try to then recharacterize those not as arguments about political prudence, but as legalistic arguments or legal arguments. They undermine the legal case, and they also, I think, make it easier for the House and others to brush off what I think are much more challenging prudential arguments.
Yeah, I think that there's also an element of being spooked by their failure of some of the previous hearings, including the legendary Corey Lewandowski shambolic circus, and that they didn't want to go to that. Okay, something else that's going on that I wanted to talk to you about. The Supreme Court is back in town, back in business, and there's an interesting debate about the Supreme Court, but there's always an interesting debate. There's a particularly interesting debate, and I want to talk about that right after a word from our sponsors.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Adam White. So, Adam, the Supreme Court is beginning its new session, and there's some huge cases. But I want to talk about something that you have called attention to, which is this new attack on the legitimacy of the court. It almost feels redundant to say that the court is at the center of this huge cultural legal war, because it feels like it's been that way for the last 20 years. But things seem to be heating up in a rather dramatic way. So can you talk about a little bit about this question of the court's actual legitimacy, in case people haven't heard about this?
Yeah, the issue goes back more than 20 years. I mean, it really is timeless. Just a few moments ago, I was in my seminar with students reading, you know, the Federalist Papers and document and Lincoln, you know, and others of the early era of our nation, talking about the place of the court in our government and in our country. So these are timeless debates. They seem to be as amplified as almost ever, as energized as ever these days. And we've seen, you know, after just a moment ago discussing the legitimacy of the impeachment process, we see questions raised or attacks on the legitimacy of the court. We've seen it. I mean, we've seen a lot of this ever since the moment Justice Kennedy announced his retirement, and it was clear President Trump was going to name his successor. But we've seen just in the last few weeks, late summer, we saw a number of senators led by Senator Whitehouse file a brief in the Supreme Court. It's called a friend of the court brief, but that's putting it generously, a real attack, a threat against the court in a case involving gun regulations, where the senators said in a brief that the court is broken and it needs to heal itself, and that to take the wrong move in this gun case, to declare, you know, that the Second Amendment supersedes the regulations at issue, would only further damage the court's own legitimacy. And we've seen now Chief Justice Roberts, shortly before the court resumed its work, he gave a talk in New York. It was covered in the New York Times and a lot of other publications, where the chief says too many people want to bring too many political issues or social issues or cultural issues into the court, and they're only setting themselves up for disappointment. There's only so much the courts can do. The court is not a political partisan body. Now, the court just resumed its work last week, as you mentioned. They started with a bang. The first couple of major cases involved whether the federal civil rights laws prohibit employers from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation and sexual identity. Obviously, one of the most hot-button issues of our time. And later this year, we're going to have cases on immigration and on a variety of other issues. This case, this year, I think, will be even more heated than the last year. And just wait 8 months from now, as people start to wonder whether a justice will retire at the end of the term, I think the entire country's hair is going to be on fire around the Supreme Court.
Let's talk about this, the attack on the court's legitimacy. Let's go back to first things. What is legitimacy? What does that mean? And what are the consequences if the court is widely seen as illegitimate?
Well,
let's define legitimacy first.
And the way you just phrased it is important. We should think about the court's legitimacy, and we should think about the court's perceived legitimacy. And these might be the same thing. I think they're different. The court's legitimacy, I believe, focuses on whether the court is doing its proper job in the context of our constitutional republic, with an eye to both the fact that we have a rule of law and we have Republican accountability. James Madison referred to this as the genius of Republican liberty. And I think the key then, in a nutshell, is for the court to say what the law is, but always in cases of doubt or cases where the law is unclear, to always leave at least some space for democratic decision-making in the states, in Congress, and in the execution of law. I think it's a risk both on the right and the left to ask the courts to just micromanage more than they really should. But then separate from all that is the perceived legitimacy. It's the question whether the people, the actual people at a given moment in time, treat the court as legitimate. And I think Chief Justice Roberts, more than anybody else as the Chief Justice, has to navigate both of those concerns, the court's actual legitimacy and the court's perceived legitimacy in the eyes of the public.
So what's the worst case scenario? That the court issues a ruling and that a large portion of the country, states, localities, other political party just simply says, we think that's just partisan hackery and we're going to ignore it?
I'd say the worst case scenario would be that if a popular uprising against the court, fomented by especially Democratic presidential candidates, leads us to a place where either 2 years from now or 6 years from now, a Democratic president with a Democratic Congress adds 3 or 5 seats to the Supreme Court to cancel out Trump's appointees. And at that point, we will cease to have a real court. What we'll have is because that will be then followed by court packing by Republicans, their next opportunity. And we'll have a court that gets bigger and bigger, looking more and more like a legislature, less and less like a court, until we truly don't have a Supreme Court anymore.
Yeah, and there'll be no way to stop that cycle.
Yeah.
Once it's done the first time, it becomes irresistible for the other party to say, we are not going to be doing that. Because we've seen exactly how things work, that if one party misbehaves, the other party then sees that as a license to misbehave similarly.
Yeah, we saw it beginning with the Democrats' treatment of Bork and Thomas. We saw it when Harry Reid finally eliminated the judicial filibuster.
Yep, filibuster, perfect example.
And, you know, I thought that what McConnell and Grassley did in holding open the seat for eventually for Neil Gorsuch, I thought that was just and correct and well-founded in history. And I wrote about it a lot at the time. The fact is, Democrats see it quite differently, and they would hold it up as a counterexample of a time when Republicans broke a norm that's going to have terrible consequences going forward.
You know, help me out here a little bit, because you're dealing with college students who are studying. Are you teaching undergraduate or law school students?
At George Mason, I teach law students.
It must be extraordinary being a student now studying the Federalist Papers and watching our history unfold. There must be a very interesting cognitive dissonance to sit down and read the Federalist Papers. I find them incredibly valuable, incredibly relevant, and incredibly depressing right now.
Well, there's a lot of that. The students these days, the students I come across, they all seem uniquely concerned with the legitimacy question. It's one of the things I'm thinking about it so much myself. I will say, when you go back and look at not just the Federalists, but the people that, say, Hamilton was arguing with, one writer under the pen name of Brutus, a lot of concerns from the very beginning were raised about the role of the court in our country. And in some ways, the fights about the court today, they seem to echo the debates that Hamilton and Brutus were having hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Of course, Hamilton and his writings on the court, on the executive branch, on the appointments process, on the electoral college, it is hard not to read that and then just sort of mourn what's coming of our country and our institutions. And the question is, how do we rebuild those institutions?
You know, you mentioned some of the Democratic candidates floating the idea of packing the court. Interestingly enough, even people like Mayor Pete, who is otherwise, I think, relatively reasonable on a variety of things. But, you know, you do watch these candidates and wonder whether or not we are seeing the moving of the Overton window on a variety of issues. And I'm thinking of Beto O'Rourke, who is out there just flailing to get attention. And apparently he's decided that taking the most extreme position on every issue, regardless of constitutional norms, is the way to do that. You know, earlier he came out in favor of mandatory buybacks of assault weapons. And mandatory buyback is really the equivalent of confiscation. People may quibble about the words, but I mean, the government is forcing you to give it up. It does compensate you, but it is literally coming and taking your guns away from you against your will. And then last week, I don't know whether you had any thoughts on this, when he's asked whether or not nonprofits that do not support gay marriage should continue to be tax exempt, he very, very bluntly said that no, he favored stripping tax exempt status from any institution, whether it is a church, a nonprofit, presumably a mosque, that did not support gay marriage. Now, not all Democrats favor that. But I'm watching on social media how when these ideas, these extreme ideas are presented, that people go, well, maybe we should do that. Yes, let's actually, you know, consider that. Maybe none of these churches should have tax exempt status. And so it's very easy for me to see how ideas that are extreme and out of the mainstream can become, you know, can move into, I won't say the mainstream, but can actually, you know, pose a threat to the political equilibrium, because we've seen that on the right with Trumpism. Yeah. So this is what concerns me about how divided we can become as we sort of spiral with one overreach after another.
That's right. I'd say Beto's comment about nonprofits, religious nonprofits, just reconfirms the concerns that helped get Trump elected in the first place, going back to the Obergefell case, where the Obama administration's Solicitor General punted on that issue, raising all the worst fears about what a Hillary Clinton administration might do. You said that, you know, even reasonable Democratic candidates are gravitating towards really unreasonable and radical action on the court. I think that shows how much political energy there is in the Democratic Party on these issues. Something interesting happened just recently. One of the activist groups on the left, a group called Demand Justice, they created their own short list of Supreme Court nominees, and they're calling upon Democratic candidates to endorse the list. It's interesting that the Democratic candidates haven't yet come up with lists of their own, and I took that to be their silence to be sort of recognition that their preferred Supreme Court justices would not be political assets in this campaign, that Trump could win a lot by campaigning on judges. Democratic presidents probably aren't confident that they can win by announcing who the kind of people they would want to put on the Supreme Court. It'd be very interesting to see how the candidates react to this list. If you look at this list, I'm not saying everybody on this list is a total radical, but there are some there that come from very, very ideologically polarized or polarizing groups. And if candidates were to put this list of people in front of the voters, I don't think the voters would react very well. I think that's why the candidates themselves have been so slow to do it.
That is interesting. So tonight I'm actually going out to Madison to speak to the UW-Madison Young Republicans or Republican Club, which is apparently quite Trumpy these days. I imagine that there's a division of opinion. So it's going to be a difficult it's going to be one of those difficult moments where you know that at least half the people in the room are going to walk out really hating what I had to say. So let me bounce this off you. Here's my goal, is that I know that I'm going to offend and really piss off a lot of the people there by things that I say and answers to various questions. Not because I intend to be obnoxious. I just intend to tell them what I think. But I know that they're going to be very, very unhappy. So my goal is to at least plant some seeds that 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, God knows, maybe 20 years from now, they'll look back on that and say, okay, that really ticked me off. I really disagreed with that, but maybe I should have listened. You know what I'm saying? That every once in a while, have you had that experience where somebody says something to you and you're really annoyed with them, and then years later you think about it and go, damn, that was right. That's my goal for tonight. That's my modest goal.
Well, we can all look forward to the triumph of hope over experience. I applaud your optimism. I'd say that, you know, especially in legal audiences, these are my friends. I understand why they supported President Trump. I understand the importance of good judicial nominations for the long run. These days, when I try to speak to audience like this, I'll be speaking at the William & Mary Law School tomorrow on judicial restraint, getting back to our earlier conversation. Right now, a lot of my talks focus on issues of self-restraint, on civic and Republican virtue, these sorts of long-term topics that I think my friends and my audiences know are correct. We're just in a difficult moment in applying those. And so hopefully lessons like that will work for the long run.
Yeah, we, you know, well, of course, we'll all be dead in the long run, but they have a longer run than I have. So we'll see how it goes. I will report back afterwards, okay?
Well, good luck.
Okay, so Adam White, thank you so much for joining us again on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it every time you come on.
Glad to be here.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.